listening to news, lectures, dialogue, documentary interviews, book reviews, and music.
I'm Joseph Sani, Technical Advisor at the Civil Society and Peace Building Department at FHI 360 in Washington, D.C. The title of the lecture today is International Peacebuilding Interventions and Local Ownership, Challenges and Dilemmas. But before I begin with the presentation, I would like to thank the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation for this invitation. Pleasure and a great honor to share my work and hopefully to learn from the audience during the questions and comments section of this program. As I look at this issue, last week I was watching and following the news and seeing what was going on in South Sudan, in Mali, in Somalia, and was reminded that unfortunately we live in a place where peacebuilding interventions are needed and will still be around for some time. Violent conflict and instability affect at least 1.5 billion people around the world. International intervention in conflicts or in so-called fragile states has become the norm. Billions of US dollars are invested. And we also know that major institutions such as the United Nations, the World Bank, donor agencies such as USAID, DFID, have put local ownership, or at least in their rhetoric, local ownership front and center of the interventions. And as I was preparing for this lecture, I think two quotes sum up the issue in my mind. The first quote from Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General. He says, and I quote, "National ownership is the core principle of peace building, and the restoration of national capacity to build peace must therefore be at the heart of the international effort." And the second quote comes from a woman I admire, one of the most seasoned peace builders. This is Mary Anderson. And she says, and I quote, "International foreign aid, when it is provided in the context of a conflict or a context of any society, becomes a part of that context." End of quote. Actually, help me prepare this lecture. The present lecture will then discuss the challenges to reconcile these two lessons, which boils down to the question of how to facilitate or leverage on local ownership of peace building programs funded by outsiders or international organizations. As we know, peace building interventions take place in a context of violence, mistrust, and deep grievances. Therefore, I think it is relevant to know who can own these interventions, what can be owned and hopefully sustained, how to avoid exacerbating the patterns of injustice or abuses or some drivers of conflict. Also, can ownership help transform relationships and address root causes of conflict? These are important questions. Unfortunately, I don't think we will have the time to cover them all today. Presentation, I hope to start the conversation. So in doing so, I will start by really briefly introducing the notion of peace building and local ownership. And the second part of the presentation, we will discuss a little bit more challenges and dilemmas related to local ownership in the context of peace building program. Then I will conclude inside our recommendations. So what do we mean by peace building interventions? In a nutshell, I will say peace building intervention in this case are a series of interventions or strategies in the form of advocacy, capacity strengthening, education, networking, that aim at transforming relationships between actors or individuals in a given society torn apart by war. They aim at changing or disrupting oppressive structures and institutions. In this case, we are talking about resolving, addressing, mitigating structural violence. They also aim at strengthening structures and institutions that support peace and satisfy people's basic human needs. They also empower people so that they can sustain themselves and the environment. So those are my four key takeaways as far as defining or capturing what peace building interventions are all about. Let me turn into what we mean by local ownership. The notion of local ownership is not new. It's been around as we have discussed. While this notion has rallied development practitioners, unfortunately, there is no agreed upon definition. Unlike peace building, where there is some sense of consensus around the definition, if you will, local ownership is a little controversial in terms of defining what it is. There are two major schools of thoughts, or two way of thinking about it. One, there are those who argue that the notion of local ownership is meaningful as long as it's not a goal to be achieved by foreign donors or interveners, but rather a means, an asset to build upon for the success of peace-building intervention. This implies that while the main responsibility and the locus or the repository of ownership lies ultimately with the local actors, international or foreign actors can facilitate but not create it. For these authors, local ownership can be achieved but requires that local stakeholders are involved in every aspect of the decision-making process and the design, and also agree with the outcome of the interventions or the project for that matter. The second school of thought, though, argue that local ownership has become a politically motivated catch-all word rather than a genuine development concept that helps deliver what it promises. In other words, the rhetoric has gone far beyond the substance. Some in this school of thought see local ownership as a practical euphemism for exit strategies, as it provides foreign actors with the theoretical justification for exit. That argument is also shared, if you want, by those who perceive local ownership as a concept used to disguise the power asymmetry that is inextricably linked to international interventions. In that same vein, local ownership as a concept is very complex and cannot be observed, measured. Therefore, it's an elusive concept. My takeaway from this whole debate is that, for me, I tend to look at local ownership more as an expression of the will of local stakeholders in supporting the project and sustaining it through the use of existing and acquired capacities and resources. If we want to operationalize local ownership, from my perspective, it has a process aspect to it and an outcome aspect. So the process is that transformation of that local will or commitment into support of the interventions or the program or the project. So there's that process of transformation, which means also genuine involvement of local actors. And variable, if I have to operationalize local ownership in terms of variables that can be measured, or three main variables, that is commitment by local actors, and that can be operationalized, contributions, what they bring, and improve capacity. So there is local ownership when there is commitment, contribution, and capacity. Those are the three main concepts that really help me operationalize local ownership in the context, particularly of peace building program, but even in general as well. So I will now turn into looking at the challenges and the dilemma faced when we want to marry these two concepts, local ownership in
this section,
peace building. I will explore the various challenges and dilemmas posed when considering local ownership in international peace building interventions. In fact, local ownership implies a redefinition of relationships among stakeholders, and this comes with a series of challenges. In reality, these challenges are common to most international development interventions, but they are amplified in the context of peace building because of the context itself, which is generally we know that peace building interventions take place in contexts where there is violence, whether structural or physical, there is lack of trust, a lot of suspicions, and frankly a capacity deficit because of different reasons mentioned above. And we also know that uniquely to peace building, there is a need to be very inclusive. The importance of bottom-up processes cannot be overstated in the context of peace-building interventions. So, given that, I identify three categories of challenges. These categories are linked, in fact, to our own definition of local ownership, which is the transformation of local wills into support or contributions and resources. And so we have challenges linked to commitment. Those related to that are those linked to capacity, and also challenges linked to the nature of owners, local owners. Who are the local owners, or the risk related to local actors? So in terms of commitment, there are three main challenges, in fact. There is one, the notion of the power. Power is symmetry that some critics of local ownership have mentioned, which is real. And there are opportunistic behaviors and what I will call the casino syndrome. So let's come back to the issue of power or symmetry. The concept of power asymmetry represents an important issue in the debate of local ownership, as we have seen. The main criticism is that the power asymmetry that exists between donors and international recipients and local recipients is a major obstacle, really, to genuine partnership and effective participation of local stakeholders. So as a result of that imbalance of power, local ownership amounts to locals accepting or the term generally used is buying into the ideas and the concepts and processes brought in by international donors. So the question then becomes how to ensure that despite this perceived power imbalance, there can still be a genuine partnership. Related to that notion of power asymmetry and the potential risk of imbalance and fake sort of buying, there is the notion of the opportunistic behavior that some locals may have. Because as a result of the imbalance and the need to have resources, some local stakeholders may adapt their priorities and mission to meet the requirement of the donor without necessarily believing in those. So they adopt an opportunistic behavior which poses a serious dilemma, because as soon as the funding dries out, they will abandon these projects and they will move to the next opportunity. So we have seen that in development programs, but more so in also peace building interventions. But local stakeholders are not the only one who are facing these problems of opportunistic behavior. The reverse to that is what I call, and I think some authors also call, the casino syndrome, which is a commitment trap, I think is the term used. The commitment trap, meaning that donors or international actors will continue to stay or invest resources with the hope that the next investment will yield better results. So in the absence of concrete results, international actors are willing to stay longer with the hope that by doing so, they will achieve results. Or the hope that the next investment, to use a casino language, will yield the biggest payoff. And so we see expressions such as, it will be stupid to leave now while the end is inside. Why leave now when we have made so much investment? So those three challenges pose a real problem to obtaining or facilitating local commitment: the power asymmetry, the opportunistic behavior, and the casino syndrome. The next set of challenges is related to capacity. Generally, as discussed previously, peace building interventions sometimes take place in the context of capacity deficit, whether from the part of the government or civil society, all communities. However, the trap here is to assume that there is nothing there. Always capacities. So it is therefore important to first assess what is there. Right? And generally, when we get into this situation with the mindset that we are dealing with, to use an anthropomorphic language, we are dealing with fragile, ill, sick society, we may miss, international peace builders may miss the opportunity to actually assess and identify core local indigenous capacities to work with. That's the first trap. The second trap is also whose capacity? It is without a clear understanding of local dynamics and the power and the dynamics of conflict, the driver of conflicts, international peace builder may run the risk to work with, in quote, maybe the wrong set of actors for the wrong set of activities. So there is a need to better understand not only the existing resources and assets, but also the dynamics between players, and also the relationships in the local environment. There is also the need to understand the capacity to contribute to a particular process. And so, because different aspects of the peace building process may require different type of capacities. So the mapping of those capacities require an engagement, an open dialogue with local actors to really identify what is needed, what can be leveraged upon, what can be sustained in terms of processes, etc. Of challenges is linked to the nature of the owners themselves. Obviously, technically, people will want to have everybody involved, every stakeholder, that is people having a stake, people being affected or affecting the process. But generally, the sudden infusions of resources and new opportunities that come with this type of international interventions, if they come without a proper distribution mechanism and processes, they may reproduce the pattern of exclusion that are already driving instability. These are situations whereby a small group of elite captures the economic peace dividend without any incentive, tuition, and structure that will enable the majority to have access to these new opportunities. It is the problem that generally is called the elite capture, whereby the urge to deliver quick results. Unfortunately, even in peace building interventions, which by essence should be time sense, should be really on the long term, sometimes there is a need to achieve quick results, maybe to build confidence in the process, but in the urgency to achieve quick results may push interveners or may push international actors to work with people who apparently may have the capacity to do so, but may not be the genuine actors or the most committed ones to drive the process. So those are some of the challenges. And as I said at the beginning, these challenges and dilemmas faced by peace builders are faced by many people working in international development, but they are particularly acute in the context of peace building interventions. Now, I will turn to the discussion around what can be done to address some of these challenges. Obviously, there is no single magic activity or solution. Instead, I will suggest some approaches and processes that have been used with relative success. And I hope that during the conversation, the questions and comments, we will enrich our understanding of
getting into approaches what needs to be done to facilitate local ownership in peace building interventions. I would just want to remind the audience that local ownership in this context is a dynamic process that occurs when committed local stakeholders participate in the design of a project, an intervention, or a policy, and contribute to its implementation in a sustainable way. So local ownership is therefore not a binary concept where one can simply answer with a yes or a no, or say it is there or it is not there. It is best understood as a process in a continuum. The layer can be defined around policy elements, such as inputs, output, or outcomes. It is the interplay. If we want to operationalize it in order to measure it, which is beyond this lecture, but part of my research, we can operationalize it around three critical notions. The notion of local commitment, the notion of local capacity, and the local contributions. So commitment to the intervention, the capacity to contribute to the intervention, and the type of contribution made. So it is in fact a composite indicator. Having said that though, let me turn back to the issue of approaches that I may suggest. I think none of these approaches is original. It's probably is most of those approaches are known by your audience. But what is important, I think, is that peace building intervention in the context of local ownership, more than ever, should be conflict sensitive, meaning that they should be grounded in a good understanding of the conflict dynamics in that environment so that they do not exacerbate conflict. It means a good use of conflict analysis, and there are tools for doing this type of conflict analysis, you know, to help understand the grievances, factors of resiliency, parties, and trends. Also, a good system view, recognizing that the minute we intervene in the particular context, we are part of the system, and taking that information into consideration to avoid exacerbating drivers of conflict. People may ask the question, how peace building interventions, why do peace building interventions need to be conflict sensitive? Because it is a myth. There is an assumption that peace building interventions are conflict sensitive, but the reality is that not all peace building interventions are conflict sensitive if they don't take into consideration other conflict dynamics. They may end up, in fact, exacerbating conflict. There are a couple of examples we may discuss later in the Q&A. The next process, though, is, or my recommendation will be, to integrate learning in the intervention. Learning is important in many ways. As we know, unstable and conflict-torn society are complex and constantly changing, which presents a challenge for interventions. It is therefore critical for this intervention to be flexible and responsive to the dynamic environment by integrating new learning, feedback, contextual realities. As such, learning goes beyond knowing what works well. It's also knowing what can impact your project, what can impact the intervention, what can affect it, or who is affecting the intervention. And secondly, learning is also a way to alter the perceived power asymmetries between international intervener and local actors. Something we have discussed, and we have seen it say as a barrier or a challenge to obtaining local ownership. In fact, more than just affecting the intervention and the processes of the intervention, learning in the form of institutional learning also influences the behavior and the commitment of stakeholders. Local stakeholders are then empowered to participate and contribute to the discussion over the improvement of the processes. By so doing, their capacity is affirmed, and their contribution is appreciated. And this process tends to mitigate the crushing effect of power asymmetry. So therefore, learning appears to be a critical process that allows, on one hand, adaptability and course correction, and on the other hand, also transform the nature of relationships among different stakeholders. And there are many tools to help organizations and stakeholders capture this kind of learning. There is a whole set of tools on the complexity-aware monitoring and evaluation processes that help organizations and stakeholders can use to prepare their organization to learn and to integrate change. So in addition to integrating learning, intervention must facilitate genuine participation. I think when we mean genuine, it's a type of participation where locals are involved both in the decision-making process and also in taking initiative in terms of their responsibility to affect the design and the implementation of project. So it's not just information or consultations, but actually co-designing and co-implementing, and hopefully in the long run co-funding the process. With these three processes, we can begin, again, it's not a divinity, we can begin to address in a constructive way the issue facilitating local ownership in peace building interventions. I will conclude by saying that looking at the interaction between international actors and local stakeholders in peace building process through the lenses of conflict sensitivity and with a commitment to participation and learning provides new insights that will help understand the power dynamics, address some of the challenges posed by local ownership in these interventions. Processes of participation, of learning, will help, I believe, facilitate local ownership in international peacebuilding interventions. They are not the answers, the complete answer, but they are part of the solutions. And I hope that we will explore more solutions and strategies and ways to discuss and understand these two concepts in the course of questions and comments. Thank you. I look forward to your questions and comments.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, our esteemed guest for today's lecture. For those who are just joining us, we've been listening to an important lecture by our guest lecturer, esteemed guest lecturer, Dr. Joseph N. Sani. Dr. Joseph Sani is a technical advisor in the Civil Society and Peace Building Department at FHI 360. He just delivered an important lecture on peace building interventions and local ownership. I would just want to thank him for this great, inspiring, thought-provoking lecture that he just delivered. Dr. Joseph, we just want to thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for those who are just joining us, especially our listeners, those who are in our studio already, who've called in, those who are listening on our website, those who are listening from other channels where we are broadcasting this important summer lecture live, you have an opportunity right now to call in to ask questions. And the number to call is 323-642-1236. Again, you can call 323-642-1236 to add your voice to this very conversation. And if you are calling from outside the United States, make sure you dial 1 before 323-642-1236. I am your host, Basil Ogorji. Dr. Joseph Sani, you have delivered an important, a very timely lecture and some of the thoughts or some of the points that you raised in this very lecture are very critical. And I'm sure our listeners, our community, those who have listened to this important lecture, have many questions because you raised very fundamental, important questions on building peace or peace building interventions and local ownership. These are very important issues when it comes to conflict resolution, international development, and peace building. And I just want to summarize again a very important three elements that resonate with me as you were talking about these peace building interventions and local ownership. And these are three elements are commitment to the intervention, capacity to contribute to the intervention, and quality or quantity of contribution made to the intervention that interveners or those who are peace builders, international peace building people who have gone to local places or other countries or war-torn regions to assist them. The kind of quality and quantity of contribution made by local people, local peace builders, peacemakers in those regions is a very important element that needs to be discussed further. And you also raised challenges to local ownership of peace-building interventions, the power dynamics. This is a very important question. Challenges are posed, many challenges posed to the process. But again, in addition to raising these challenges, you also proposed solutions. And you actually articulated that there should be a process of participation by local actors, give local actors the opportunity to participate in the process. By so doing, they have ownership of the process and not just, participating, but again, they should be actively involved, engaged in designing the process. And again, in learning opportunities, these are very important points that you raised. But personally, I want to approach your lecture from a different perspective, which is not completely different from what you have said. In 1997, Liderac, John Paul Liderac, who is one of the conflict resolution, peace building experts that we actually know, people who began this field of conflict resolution, wrote a book. The book is entitled Building Peace, Sustainable Reconciliation in Divided Societies. This book was published in 1997. And in this book, John Paul Liderac identified two important areas that honestly resonate with me as you were talking about peace building interventions and local ownership. And these two areas are what he refers to as resources for sustainable transformation, and they are social economic resources and social cultural resources. I'm sure you detailed these points in your presentation. Now, for socio-economic resources that are needed for local actors, for local people to have ownership of the process, he identified categories of action, which honestly you also talked about it, responsibility and accountability, strategic commitment, which is a very important point that you raised in your presentation. Now, my question will have to do with responsibility and accountability. Most often in many countries, there is a problem, a question that many foreign development agencies face. They actually feel that local actors sometimes do not have well-defined way of becoming accountable to the process. For instance, evaluation, monitoring and evaluation, especially in developing countries where after peace building initiatives sponsored by donor countries. At the end of the day, we discover that some of these initiatives are not well evaluated or monitored. Honestly, those are, you know, work that are being done, initiated, sometimes are seen as not even making, helping, contributing in developing or even resolving the conflicts that, you know, were at the origin of the intervention. So how do we deal? This is a very important question that I want to ask you. I know many of our listeners have got questions for you. How do we deal with, you know, especially many people are talking about, you know, kind of problems that have to do with not using the resources, or for instance, the money that are invested for the men work, the projects that are designed to be implemented. So how do we deal with corruption? That's a very important point. You know, how do we deal with corruption? Because it's actually a problem in many countries, especially in developing countries. There are a lot of investments by development agencies and donor countries. And often it seems to me that because of corrupt practices, there is no trust. And most of these local actors sometimes are not trusted or revert and actually deal with this very important issue. That is number one question. I'm sure you're gonna you have many answers to that very point. There is also another issue that Liderat raised, and this has to do with social cultural resources. And I'm not going to be looking at the social cultural resources as you have completely detailed it or detailed them in your presentation, but I'm going to be looking specifically at peace constituency or cultural resources. Building a peace constituency in conflict zones is actually very important. And this summarizes in one way or the other the whole presentation that you have made. People should be seen as resources themselves and not recipients. This should be a citizen-based peacemaking approach, right? And it must be seen as being instrumental and integral, right, to the process as a way of sustaining change. So it should be a citizen-based approach. Now, there are so many civil society organizations. If we have to be a little bit specific in many countries, civil society organizations, and sometimes these are civil society organizations that are abbreviated as CSOs, right, in developing countries. Often, these organizations are not well-organized. There is no coordination in their actions. How do we honestly coordinate, bring coordination to the actions and the work of civil society organizations such that there's going to be coherence in their interventions and in their efforts to have ownership of the peace building interventions that are being sponsored by donor countries and donor agencies? This is very important. I know the United Nations has done a great deal of work through its Economic and Social Council ECOSOC status, right, of bringing in together at the international level local civil society actors or organizations. But again, not all the civil society organizations are part of the ECOSOC, Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. And again, people who are there, organizations are there, you know, organizations that have got money. There are so many civil society organizations at the grassroots level. How do we coordinate their actions and assist them so they can leverage on best practices and lessons learned in the implementation of the of the work. And many of them do not even have funding anyway from donor countries. Those who have funding from donor countries are the organizations that are well-structured, have got a whole lot of things to show and meet the requirements of the USAID, for instance, and many other donor agencies. It's a rigorous process. But again, grassroots organizations that are at the bottom where the conflicts are actually taking place, how do we assist those people? This is a very important question that I know you got a lot of answers to this. The last question that I'm going to ask you before I yield is has to do with building on cultural resources, which honestly you talk so much about in your presentation, recognition of the existing local resources, modalities, and mechanisms for building peace. Liderach, in 1997, in that book, Building Peace, Sustainable Reconciliation in Divided Societies, articulated this very important point. And the example that honestly comes to mind is what Liderach talked about, emerging model from Central Africa, which has to do with supporting the principles of peace building. And personally, I have a personal experience in Rwanda after the genocide of 1994. The Rwandan government initiated a national unity and reconciliation program, which is a little bit similar to what happened in South Africa. But again, the Rwandan government really tried with the citizens, the post-genocide citizens of Rwanda, by revitalizing the Gacaca courts. And this Gacaca court is the traditional method of reconciliation, of conflict resolution. So how do we, in the process of having ownership of peace building interventions, how do we revitalize the traditional methods of conflict resolution that these local actors themselves, peace builders, local actors at the grassroots levels actually know how to use, and they're very much familiar with that. And that is a little bit different from the Western approach to conflict resolution, which is more or less a statistic diplomacy and not, designed to kind of touch upon the core issues at the grassroots level. And that brings us to the question of networking and also trust. These local actors are those who are trusted and who have the ability to network within the community. So the question of revitalization or revitalizing local traditional peace building methods, using them as a way to address the current problems that these people face at the local level. Dr. Joseph, these are core issues that I've just raised listening to your presentation that resonate with me, and I would yield now and hope that you will share your thoughts on these questions.
Thank you, Basil. I'm glad that that the presentation will stimulate such important points. And I'm glad that you mentioned John Paul Lederer, because these are the people who really who have pushed the boundaries of our field. And I think it's really a pleasure. To know that people like that are around and they can help us move forward in the field. To address some of your questions, I think you are raising important questions here. I will start with the last one, building this on cultural resources. I think in general, and when I bring it to the framework of local ownership, it's part of the contribution local can make. I think it's important to appreciate that contribution because, unfortunately, we tend to see contribution in terms of dollar amount, unfortunately. And that's how we define, and it goes deeper. It goes to the issue of power as well. The most powerful party is the party that is bringing the money. But I think there are local resources, and you mentioned some of those, that only locals, local actors, local stakeholders can bring. Legitimacy, for example. I mean, your intervention has to be legit, like, needs that veil of legitimacy. If it is not legitimate, that is accepted by locals themselves, it will not work. Things like trust or local knowledge. We may have the organizational knowledge, management, etc., but you lack the local knowledge, how to make meaning of certain of the context itself, of some processes. So these are part of resources that can only be found in the local environment. And these and are part of the contribution only local can make. And one of the things I recommended, I suggested, is when we say these interventions have to be conflict sensitive, analyzing this kind of local resources is part of making sure that the intervention is conflict sensitive, because you want to understand what brings the community together. What are the systems? What are the assets? What are the values? What are the practices that can bring the community together? This is that locals rely on to solve their issues. You mentioned Gacaca in Rwanda, for example. And then there were other practices. I mean, in some society, like in Sierra Leone, I remember, there were processes of cleansing to reintegrate child soldiers in the community. These are local cultural resources we have to consider as we intervene in this kind of context. And they are part of the contribution, because when these resources are appreciated, are recognized, are integrated, they build up that momentum of local ownership, I think. You mentioned the issue of building peace constituency and CSO register, former CSO versus CBO, etc. I think this is also another important issue. Who can own the process? Who can own the interventions? The process can only be owned by former CSOs or CBOs, and people who are not even affiliated to any kind of organization, or just leaders or elders or women in the village, can they own the process even though they are not organized? These are the questions. We should not let legal status be an obstacle to genuine ownership. No, there are many ways to organize these informal networks into formal entity, and sometimes maybe organizing them into formal entity kills that legitimacy, the trust they have from the community. But my point is, don't limit yourself to the formal institutions when we do this kind of interventions, because we may run the risk of falling into the trap of elite capture. We end up working with the most connected, but the less committed. The most committed can be the less connected. So they are committed, but because they don't speak English, they don't speak the language of organizational design and evaluation and stuff, they may be left out, and you keep working with the most connected, but who don't really believe in the project. They are driven by opportunism. So my advice and my response is, first of all, it's important to make that distinction. Who are the most committed people, okay, or organizations? Not necessarily looking for the most connected. Of course, in some cases, the most committed can be the most connected, which is good. But we should not stop there. And secondly, now, depending on the context, we will find ways to put these committed agents together, to engage them in the process some way, find ways to really work with them, because what you want to do is to work with the most committed people, because commitment is key to ownership. If people are not committed, they will not own that process, even parts of that process, you know. And so that will be my answer, which is always look for the most committed people, the most committed organization. And there are ways to know. I mean, commitment can be operationalized in terms of past experiences, in terms of individual experience, in terms of the current work they are doing. I mean, we can find ways to measure or assess commitment. And then, I mean, in the field of organizational design, there are many ways to assess that. But it may take time. It may take also another mindset, because sometimes I must admit we are working on short timelines, and so we want quick results. And the imperative of quick results pushes some organization to work with the most connected people who can speak the language and produce quick reports and move on. And then so we tick that box and say we have done it. But I think it requires time to find out the most committed people, and it may require some initial investment, because the most committed may not have the capacity to deliver some activities. So it times is important, and I mean there are many ways to organize the most committed organization actors locally. There are many ways. How to deal with the issue of corruption in the context? I think this is a bigger issue. Again, it comes to what we mentioned in the lecture, the opportunistic behavior. Corruption is an opportunistic behavior. I'm not an expert on anti-corruption, but I think when there is commitment, particularly commitment to the outcome of a peace-building activity, people will, and then if they are considered as partners, I think they are less likely to engage in this type of opportunistic behaviors. And again, people can be committed. Again, so let me break this down. Whenever this type of interventions, generally we have input, we have output, we have outcomes. So people may, input can be the money, input can be all kind of resources that go into it. Output can be the type of activities, and outcomes are actually the results. And so we need people who are committed to the whole thing, input, output, results. So again, if you have really, really committed actors who feel like they are being trusted and treated like partners, I think you will reduce the incidence of corruptions and this type of the opportunistic behavior. I mean, I'm sure people dealing with corruption have different organizational way. I mean, I'm not talking about organizational way of dealing with corruption, because there are many strategies, I'm sure. I'm just, from a peace-building perspective, that will be my recommendation. Try to work with the most committed actors and treat them as genuine partners.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joseph Sunny. We have another question from Aliyah. Aliyah is calling from Washington, D.C. I want to welcome Aliyah to ask her questions to Dr. Joseph. Aliyah?
Yes, hi. Thank you so much, Doctor, for the very nice and good presentation. And thank you, as a host, for your questions. Actually, you asked three of my four questions. One question I want to ask is the sanctions. When we talk about peace building, and you talk about commitment and ownership between local ownership and capacity and nature of local ownership and the donors. And you talk also about the influence of power. So we know that the donors, sometimes when they want to involve in peace building in any conflict zone, they face the corruption, and they face not only corruption, but sometimes there is sanctions from international community against specific countries, and you mentioned South Sudan when you start your presentation, and Sudan and Darfur, especially Darfur too. I know you have work in that area, because I'm originally Sudanese, and I have some work there too. However, we face all the time not only the local government intervention, but obstacles from them, as well as from international communities. So how can we work through sanctions to help building peace in conflict zones, in especially Africa or Asia?
So the issue of sanctions, that's a very tough question, because we can still do local peace building, under sanctions, I think. So you are raising two main issues here. I mean, sanction is one type of, one issue, which frankly I cannot speak to that. I'm not well versed into how they work. I may have my opinions. And with peace building, sometimes the two can collide, because people, when sanctions are put as a way to create some kind of behaviors, or they want to encourage, or they want to see something happen, change. So we use the stick approach we put on sanctions. But that can contradict some of the peace building outcomes, right? So you may actually discourage parties into conflict to engage into peace because you have put sanctions. And again, it comes back to the point I was making, is every time we intervene in a conflict setting, we have to be mindful of the consequences, not just the intentions, but the consequences of our action, or the unintended consequences of our actions. And that's the conflict sensitivity approach. I remember, for example, in a situation like in Uganda, I'm not sure that the sanctions towards, or the fact that Kony was indicted, contributed or not to peace. So again, we have to be, my only takeaway or my answer to this question is, if we decide to apply sanctions, we have to be mindful or cognizant of the fact that there may be some unintended consequences, and particularly maybe peace can be the casualty of the sanctions. And we have to analyze those before putting those sanctions in place. Sanctions are not not the only answer, particularly in the context of when we are talking about peace building. I think that will be the last tool. A peace builder will use, obviously. But people putting sanctions should be mindful of the fact that there may be some unintended consequences. That would be my take. I'm not an expert on sanction policy, but from a peace building perspective, I think sometimes the first casualty of sanction is not the people upon which the sanctions are imposed, but generally the first casualty is peace. It's peace. I don't know if I cover that question, but that would be my take.
So much, Joseph Sunny, for the wonderful responses you provided to the answer. I hope Aliyah, I hope Dr. Joseph, to your satisfaction.
Yes, thank you.
Perfect. Joseph, we have Ryan Jacobs, who's one of our colleagues here at the International Center for Ethno Religious Mediation. But again, Ryan has an important question for you. Ryan?
Yes, thank you so much, Basil, and thank you so much, Dr. Joseph Sani, for being a part of this. You touched upon it a bit, but applying these concepts, I was curious if you could share specific examples based on your experiences in countries such as the Ivory Coast, and also, can you provide an explanation of that conflict? Because many people in the U.S. are unaware of these sorts of conflicts.
Wow, that's to put in a summary the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire is it's a big toll. But okay, so there are many phases to the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire. The latest one was the result of electoral violence. There were elections, and then the candidates could not agree on the result of the elections. So on one hand, you had the incumbent, President Gbagbo, and on the other hand, the challenger, the current president now, President Alassane Ouattara. And they could not agree on the results. And so the conflict went on as the result of a very, ill-defined or incomplete election. So that was the last phase, because the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire is more than a decade-old conflict, a long conflict. But the last phase of violence resulted from these elections and final at the end. President Ouattara was declared the winner by the international community, and the incumbent Gbagbo went to jail, was accused of war crimes, and then the trial is still going on. So in a nutshell, that's the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire. But I studied the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire from the angle of education. So the relationship between education and conflict, and how we know that conflict affects the education system and the content, curriculum, etc. But I was interested in looking at how education can affect conflict in Côte d'Ivoire. And so we looked at it from a perspective of curriculum, perspective of the education resources between the North and the South, and also in terms of ownership. So, and then we found that there were some discrepancies between the North and the South in terms of it, as far as education, but it was not the result of, it was the result of colonial, the colonial settings that were sustained by the former president of Fodwani and followed on by subsequent presidents. So that was my involvement with the conflict in Côte d'Ivoire. Now, your question regarding if I have experienced this type of issue of local ownership, I studied this, particularly local ownership of peace-building intervention. I researched it in two countries, in Senegal and Haiti, where I did my research. So what I found was that local ownership in this context, like in Senegal, the notion of contribution, commitment, and capacity those notions were quite clear in those two cases. So the contribution of locals in the project we studied in Senegal were what Berzel mentioned before, were in form of local knowledge, trust, connection, and social capital, if you want. So locals were able to invest to bring into projects the social capital that was so needed and so critical to succeed the peace-building intervention. And that social capital, the problem was people could not quantify it, right? So they could not quantify it. And so there is this issue of how do you quantify, put in a budget, in numbers, this kind of contribution? I still can't give an answer to it, but somehow we have to recognize that contribution and value it. And when that contribution was valued by international implementers, people were implementing this project there, we saw really a shift in the role of locals. And then we saw a shift in even sustaining the project. Like in Senegal, the project we study was implemented in 2002, but in 2010, some aspects of the projects were still being implemented. I mean, 5 years after the official end of the project. So that, because of the way local contributions were valued and the way local partners were treated, made a tremendous difference in terms of sustainability. In Haiti, what we found was the notion of power asymmetry. So because one of the criticisms of local ownership, of the notion of local ownership, is the idea that international actors have so much resources, so therefore there is this power asymmetry, and then locals will just follow whatever they are told to do. So that's a myth, I think, based on our findings. Because in fact, people making that criticism have in mind the notion of power over. So the traditional notion of power, which is, I have power when I can influence you or things that you would not otherwise do. Okay, so that's power over. But there are other notions of power, which is power with, for example. The relational aspect of power, that power, in fact, is not a static notion. Power can change, and then power can change based on relationships, how we relate to one another. So the notion of power with is so important in the relationship between locals and international. And what we saw in Haiti was that, yes, at the beginning, maybe international donors and actors may have some more resources, so there may be a perceived power imbalance. But as they work together with local actors, as they learn to work together, that relationship creates a form of interdependency. So therefore, it's not even in the interest of the perceived powerful party to crush the other, the less powerful, because of that interdependency, they have to work together, and the notion of power with becomes prominent. And processes such as learning together, processes of negotiations, negotiating outcomes, discussing on the goals of the resource, the project, etc., tends to mitigate that crushing effect. And at the end of the day, in fact, the two parties, so international and locals, end up having the same influence on the initial perceived power asymmetry at the end of the project, because of processes of shared learning, negotiation, working together, etc. In fact, that power asymmetry disappears. So the argument that because of the initial power imbalance, can be an obstacle to local ownership, I think does not hold in the long run, particularly when actors are engaged in peace building projects, which brings together, highlights the interdependency between different actors. Once there is that understanding or that realization of interdependency, and supported by the process of shared learning, the imperative to achieve results together in cooperation and partnerships, the crushing effect, or the perceived crushing effect, or the expected crushing effect of power asymmetry disappears. And that power imbalance also disappears and ceases to become an obstacle to local ownership. And so that's something that we found in our project in Haiti.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joseph Sani. For those who are just joining us, those who are tuning in, we are having a conversation on peacebuilding interventions and local ownership, a lecture, distinguished lecture delivered by Dr. Joseph Sani. He is a technical advisor at the Civil Society and Peacebuilding Department at FHI 360. He's based in Washington, D.C. Joseph, we have many questions here in our chat box. A lot of people are listening to this conversation right now. And I'm going to be summarizing the questions that we have, and I'm going to put them forward to you, or just summarize them and then put them forward to you in under one question. The questions I see, as I see here, relate to mediation as a part of peace building interventions. And these questions are sent in by some of our community members and people I know from many other countries who are listening to this conversation. Let me quickly do a justice to these questions. If I don't include your own question, please, our listeners, do not take an offense. We're going to be hurrying up because of time. But again, I'm going to try as much as I can to summarize all these questions and put them forward to you. Now, mediation is a part of peace-building intervention. And in many countries in around the world, for instance, as we see what's going on in Syria or Iraq, or even in the northern part of Nigeria, or the Niger Delta area, the Niger Delta Avengers, right now, kind of fighting, claiming to fight for their own rights and destroying oil installations in Nigeria. We saw also what happened in the Central African Republic between Christians and Muslims. The questions have to do with the fact that these conflicts require some kind of mediators who are not a kind of impartial mediators. And if we need impartial mediators to bring the stakeholders, the parties to a table for resolution of their conflicts, different factions, the former person, the person who just asked the question before, earlier from DC, talked about factions at the international level. But these right now factions I'm talking about is at the local level as well. Now, the mediators at the local levels definitely have some kind of affiliation with a particular group. If we have ethnic conflicts or religious conflicts, and you want to get a mediator who is also from the grassroots level, or even what Liderac talked about as middle ranger. A middle ranger, that means people who are the middle, not top level, neither are they just people at the bottom. But again, middle ranger could be a scholar in the university, right? Or somebody who is the leader in a civil society organization and all that, so, but again, they're not occupying political positions, or are they wealthy, occupying big corporations? Now, if you want to get these people, bring them to a table to negotiate or mediate the conflicts, this kind of conflicts, religiously motivated conflicts or even ethnic conflicts, right? And in that particular area where they are, their own affiliated ethnic group, the ethnic group or religious group they are affiliated with, they're part of, is also in conflict. How do we really want to kind of justify the ethical implication of this kind of intervention by a local, person if we are advocating for local ownership? This is the question that we have here. And secondly, do you think that sometimes it might be even better to kind of get an impartial external mediator, right? Somebody who is foreign to the local situation or even to the very conflicts, right? And the processes or situations that led to the escalation of the conflict, an external, might be a foreign person, right, to mediate in order to maintain the neutrality, the ethical implications and justify the ethical implications in the resolution to be impartial, completely impartial? Or are we advocating for an insider impartial mediator, someone who is the insider? An insider, but again, at the same time, somehow impartial, just like we have chiefs or traditional rulers, right? Who might somehow, they're insiders, but again, at the same time, or even religious leaders, right? They are somehow biased because they also want to maintain the religious doctrines they are leading or they adhere to. And at the same time, they also want to resolve the conflict, leveraging on the religious doctrines, the traditional customary codes for traditional rulers. So how do we really create a balance for this kind of intervention by local actors, local mediators? So these are the two questions that emerge in so many questions that we have in our chat box.
Yeah, so you are raising another very tough one. But I think the key in terms of mediation, I think impartiality is the key. Three things as far as ownership is concerned. The parties must be willing or to look for peace, I think. Because if the parties are not ready to come together, that we are not talking the mediation here. We are dealing with other processes, shorter diplomacy, facilitation, but there must be the willingness, some sort of willingness, or we have there are many ways we can provoke that willingness, push parties to the table, so to speak. There are many ways. I will not get into those, but there must be some willingness to engage. Now, the choice of the mediator, I think the mediator has, whether it is an insider or an external mediator, I think, has to be somebody that parties trust, that he will be impartial. I mean, the concept of neutrality, it's difficult. You can't be neutral. But you can be impartial, and the impartiality, it doesn't matter if you proclaim your impartiality. What matters is believing. Do they believe that you are impartial? Okay, so that's fine. So they have to trust you, that you will be impartial in the process, right? And there is another aspect that you mentioned in your question, actually, which is local knowledge. As a mediator in that kind of context, particularly this kind of inter-community conflict, the mediator has to have a sound knowledge of the conflict, of the parties, of the conflict dynamic, the root causes, etc. So a good and the culture, the norms, the local norms, local culture. I think sound knowledge of a good knowledge of the context of the parties is critical. Generally, you will have teams of mediators. The mediator will have a team of people to help him understand the thick description of things. And you have to be motivated. It's hard work to be a mediator. It's hard work. So you have to be motivated. And you have to be transparent with your motivations, right? You can have mediators have different types of motivations. They can be motivated because of religious beliefs, moral motivation, because of moral beliefs. They want to see peace. But you have to be transparent. Why are you doing this? Why are you engaged in that process? Because if you are not motivated, it will be difficult when things get tough, and they will be tough, because you will. If mediation requires perseverance, and so those will be my criteria if I have to choose or set the job description of a mediator in that context. Somebody who is trusted to be impartial, somebody who is knowledgeable of the situation of the parties, and maybe who is connected somehow, and somebody was motivated. For me, and then now there's a whole issue of capacity, the resources, etc., etc., the logistics of it. But for me, those will be the three key things that will be part of the job description of that individual, whether it is a conflict in Nigeria, in Cameroon, or Mali, or elsewhere.
Thank you so much, Dr. Joseph Sani. We have been talking and discussing with Dr. Joseph Sani, who is an expert on peace-building interventions and the issues around local ownership of such interventions. It's been a great, great, time having you, honestly, Dr. Joseph, on the ICM Radio platform for this inspiring lecture that you just delivered. And the conversations and responses to the questions that emerged that we'll be asking you. I want to thank you so much for coming, and we honestly have many other questions here. We're going to be leaving these questions for future discussions. We could send them to you, and next time we have time, we're going to be inviting you again for some of the projects that we have on the ICM Radio platform or the other projects that our organization is organizing, just to partner with you again and leverage on your wealth of knowledge in these areas. Thank you so much, Joseph, for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And to you, our listeners, or those who are listening to our conversation, those who called in here, or those who sent in their questions, those who will be listening to the archived podcast of this lecture on our website. It's going to be on our website. And just to remind our listeners, you can always go to our website, www.isomediation.org, to listen to the archived lectures. Peace building interventions and local ownership will be archived on our website for your consumption. I'm sure it's going to be a great addition to your knowledge. Next Saturday, we'll be having an important conversation on ICM Radio, and we're going to be having another lecture. So try as much as you can to call in at 2 p.m. We're going to be listening to an expert, a very important expert on religion and conflict, religion and violence. So it's going to be a thought-provoking lecture next Saturday at 2 p.m. airing on ICM Radio platform. And do not forget to go to our website to register for our upcoming conference, the Annual International Conference on Ethnic and Religious Conflict Resolution and Peace Building. It's going to be on November the 2nd and 3rd here in New York, in Manhattan. We're going to be having that conference in partnership with the Interchurch Center in New York. Do try as much as you can to register for that important conference. With this, I'm going to be closing and ending this very conversation. I look forward to having you again next time, next Saturday, for another episode of the ICM Radio Lecture Series, the Summer Lecture Series. We thank you for your contributions. Thank you for your support. And we thank you for all those who are listening, all those who have supported us, our members, our board of directors, all the people who are part of our community, our great people of peace. Through this program, we just want to inspire peace in the world. It's a contribution to enlighten people, or people who will be listening to the podcast, or people who will be calling in to listen live, enlighten people on ways to initiate peace projects, and also foster a culture of peace around the world and among ethnics and ethnic and religious groups around the world. With this, I say peace and blessings be unto you, and I look forward to having you again next Saturday.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio,
a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ICERM Radio.
Peace to our world.